Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com. or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects on Radio at Firehouse.com. The show is hosted by Tom Shand and Mike Wilbur, the Apparatus Architects from the monthly column in Firehouse Magazine and the monthly podcast here on Radio at Firehouse. Good afternoon or good morning, fellas. What's going on? What do you have for us? I know we missed a major trade show in the last month. What's going on in the industry business?
Hey, good morning, everyone. This is Tom Shand here, and here's what we're going to be talking about today. As normal, we're going to start off the podcast with Brother Mike going down some of the news highlights of some things that have happened just with respect to apparatus across the country. We're then going to give some impressions, as Pete alluded to, as to what some of the things that transpired and what was shown and maybe some potential industry trends at the recent Fire Department Instructors Conference show. And then as a result of that, we're also going to talk a little bit about tool mounting inside the cab in our environment. We saw a number of different approaches of what people are doing of the things beyond putting our bodies and our self-contained breathing apparatus inside the cab. But we saw some very good examples and unfortunately some kind of poor examples that probably aren't safe practices of things that we saw people bringing into the cabs that were on display. Mike's going to then talk a little bit about some of the other pending changes that are coming down the road with the new NFPA 1901 standard. And then we'll finish up with going over any questions or things that people have submitted since our last podcast. So kicking off the show today, Brother Mike, what do you have for us here in terms of running down some of the more newsworthy items of what's been going on here in our great country over the last couple of weeks?
Thanks, Brother Tom. Good morning, everybody. First, would like to start out with a little news from American LaFrance and their bankruptcy troubles. We've learned earlier in the month that the creditors and the bankruptcy court and American LaFrance have all agreed in a payout, and within the next week to 10 days, we should hear more information as American LaFrance tries to move forward out of their current troubles. In talking with some American LaFrance people at the FDIC, they are building trucks. They are getting other OEMs to ship them supplies to build the trucks, and so it looks like they could be back up and running full speed shortly. More to follow in our next month's podcast on that. As far as just a weird month, Tom, of all the stuff in the news that's going on, it was really hard to pick a news story of the month as far as being weird. But and then we have just some of the same old responding Ohio fire tanker flipped over late last week in Middleton Township, driving to a personal injury motor vehicle accident, and they overturned, slid off the right shoulder on a narrow road, tried to get it back on like we talk about so often in driver training class, panicked, tried to get it back on the road, and then it hit a guardrail and a utility pole before coming to rest upside down with that apparatus. A Louisiana firefighter was struck and killed, and one other firefighter was injured on a highway incident. And again, one of the things that are just killing huge amounts of firefighters and police officers and tow truck operators and EMS personnel are operating along the roadways. In fact, the police just released their statistics for 2007, and police officers die 3-1 over gun or other kind of violence being shot versus 3 times as many operating along the roadways at accident scenes or traffic stops. So it is very dangerous along the nation's roadways as it relates to first responders.
But Mike, that statistic of the number of police officers as compared to firefighters, where'd that data come from again?
It was something that I had seen on the news. It was by the Benevolent Order of Police or something like that that has kept national statistics on police officers. And they're dying at a rate of 3 times as many, 3-1, versus you would think that police officers would be dying in gunfights and knives and being jumped or whatever. And that's just simply not the case, that the majority of their deaths are along the roadways and in traffic accidents themselves responding. So they tend to have many of the same issues that we do in the fire service, and they tend to have the same kind of nonsense excuses as far as even wearing seat belts, the gun holster, my baton, the mace spray, and everything else that you can think of are excuses that many police officers use not to wear their seat belts. And, of course, when it comes to the law of physics, as you well know, Tom, that it doesn't matter what you're riding in. If you flip it over and you're not buckled in, the chances are pretty good that you're going to be ejected out.
You know, Mike, just a sidebar. It's interesting with some of the things we're going to be talking about later with making our apparatus more visible on the highway with, you know, retro-reflective material, chevrons on the back. The innumerable number of warning lights and warning light patterns, and we're trying to standardize the look of chevrons on apparatus across the country. A couple of local police jurisdictions up here in upstate New York and the Buffalo area that traditionally had used white painted, typically the Ford Crown Vic with the police package, a white car with all different kinds of colors and graphics. A couple of these departments recently, not that I was pulled over by one, mind you, but in going in the other direction, have noticed that these people have gone to the old style black and white with like the white roof and the white midbody, but the front of the vehicle and the back of the vehicle is black. And you talk about a less conspicuous vehicle on the highway, even though they have some warning lights and stuff. That really kind of goes against the statistics that you just quoted by saying that it doesn't seem like the police are putting the amount of effort that we are in the fire service and are making our vehicles more readily visible on the highway, unless they know something that we don't know, Mike, about, you know, paint your car black and white. To me, when it used to be white with a lot of retro-reflective material, and now it's all black on the front and the back, I guess it's good if you're trying to go catch the bad guys. To me, it doesn't seem like that would be a very good color if you're out on the highway on a traffic stop.
No, and I think that's why the federal government, the U.S. Fire Administration, and the DOT, Department of Transportation, have banded together, and we're now in about the 28th month of what's going to end up being about a 3-year study on warning light packages and graphics and stuff, and really the design is for the scientists to have a scientific basis to come up with a light package for all emergency vehicles in this country, very similar to Europe, where if you are going along in Europe, whatever country, France, England, Wales, Germany, and you see a blue flashing light and you hear a beep-boop, beep-boop, you better pull over. And you don't know what it's going to be because it could be a police car or an ambulance or a fire truck, but everybody's the same and pretty standard right across the board. And I think the results of that study with the light packages should be out later in this year. And I really believe that the police brethren, along with EMS and fire, are going to ultimately have to come together on this issue and conform to what will be probably a national standard on emergency vehicle lighting and retro-reflective material. Moving on, this has almost little to do with driving, but everything to do with the fire service and the way the fire service is going as it results or as it relates to the court system in this country. A fire command officer, his trial starts today, actually, for a fire crew boss charged in connection with the deaths of four firefighters and a wildland fire that occurred. It was a 30-mile fire near Wantagee in Washington. He's been charged with four counts of involuntary manslaughter and seven counts of making false statements. And again, although it really has nothing to do with driving, it has everything to do with the fact that not only are we being sued in record numbers, but many of us are now facing legal consequences for our actions as well. Alcohol found in a civilian driver of a double fatal crash in Sacramento, in California. And what was interesting about this crash is that everything within the first week of it, although the car pulled out into the engine's path, it just really seemed like the press was trying to indict the fire department for this particular crash. And it finds out in post-accident investigation that the two young ladies that were in that car had been out clubbing, and that they, although they had the less than a legal amount to be considered drunk, they did have alcohol in their system at the time that they ran through the stop sign into the path of the fire apparatus. And so we have to wait a lot of times for post-accident investigation to realize what really has occurred. A lot of times in many of these apparatus collisions, the headlines, those early headlines, don't necessarily paint us in a very good light. And we are, you know, newsworthy, and it's kind of a flash in the pan. And then we find out really what's going on a couple of weeks later in a post-accident investigation, and we find out that what it seemed to appear to be like in the beginning isn't necessarily what exactly happened. And so a real tragedy, though, Tom, for all those involved, whether you're the driver of the apparatus at that point in time with two civilians dead, it really doesn't matter who's right or who's wrong. The fact is that there are two civilians that were killed, and there's an apparatus operator out there who's going to have to live with that for the rest of his or her life and has joined what I call in my classes now a very exclusive club of individuals in this business who have taken emergency vehicles and killed or seriously hurt civilians, and it's a club that none of us, quite frankly, want to be members of. It's very serious. Moving on, a serious non-responding apparatus crash over the weekend in Canada, where a car just ran right into a fire truck head-on this past Saturday. The apparatus was not responding. It was coming back from a call, and still don't know yet why the car just ran right into the fire truck. And it's that time of year again, Tom, where fire trucks are going to start getting trapped in the mud. And there were a couple of recent articles about that. One comes out of the state of Wisconsin, where two Neshkoro firefighters were returning from a parade in Germana when fire officials said the rural county road that they were traveling on just simply gave way under the weight of the apparatus. Both firefighters were reported to be fine, though. Any comments on that, Tom?
Well, you know, it seems like it would go without saying that you would have to be careful of you know, maneuvering the apparatus around in your community and being, you know, talk about knowing the first due area. That sometimes can be a much larger responsibility than we give it, you know, credence for. Knowing your community, how to get from one point to the other in the quickest and most safest manner is one thing. In these days of being able to have GPS capability, laptop computers in the apparatus, it kind of makes the old style of getting around in the first two that I broke into the fire service with of having good map books and a person who was pretty handy at cartography in the fire department to be able to come up with mapping for the area where the 100-block splits were, where fire hydrants are if you're in a remote locale, where public water supplies are. And I think the public takes for granted the fact that we know where we're going, but more importantly, that we know the points of access of how to get into the houses. Now, Mike and I have certainly had a fair amount of experience just even locally here in New York, where although it seems that at least it's published reports are that our state are losing taxpayers and people are going down to the desert Southwest or moving down to south and in the southern areas, the perceived high taxes. They're not perceived, they are real high taxes. And the climate conditions, yet you'll find that folks will buy some property in a place and plop a house so they get a great view, or aesthetically from the exterior, the house looks great, but it's in a locale that the fire department and their apparatus simply can't get to, either because of the physical size of the driveway, the roadway. Many times they'll build these berms or obstructions or have electrically operated access gates to, you know, kind of secure the property a little bit more. And that looks great if you're driving even a big SUV through there. Probably might not work if they put those posts on 8-foot, 8-inch centers. Your fire truck might not fit through there. So it's incumbent upon the departments to have a good working relationship, Mike, with their planning boards. And as these things come up, to make sure that the fire department is going to have access to this. And also to ensure that once you get past the colder winter months here up in the north and the ground begins to thaw a little bit, to know that you might not be able to take your 36,000-pound fire truck and cruise over that roadway the way you did when it was the dead of winter and the frost was 3 or 3.5 feet in the ground. It's kind of a tragic way to find out that things didn't work to your expectation. But, again, the expectation of the fire department is that they are supposed to know, you know, where to go, how to get there, and to arrive safely. And as we can see here, in some cases, that doesn't necessarily always happen.
Well, and I think another Mike and Tom rule is that bigger isn't always better. You know, there's no picture here in the article, but, you know, how big was the truck? How heavy was it? And what part did the design phase of that truck play into that particular event where the road gave way? So a lot happening there. A couple more notes here, and then we'll move on. A civilian runs a stop sign and collides with responding fire apparatus. And again, we talk about it being four times more likely to get in an emergency vehicle wreck with your lights and sirens on, and 10 times more likely to hurt or kill somebody in the confines of that wreck. And it becomes easy to understand after going through a couple of these where civilians, when they see us at the last minute, panic, and sometimes they may hit the gas instead of the brake. Other times, if we come up behind them, they just simply hit the brake and we have to plan for something else. But what's really tragic about this event in Albany, Georgia, is that it also goes on to say in the headlines that the firefighters were tossed within the cab. Obviously, a group that did not have seatbelts on that got into that event, but nobody, thank goodness, was seriously hurt. And in my bizarre articles of the month, here we go.
I can't wait for this one, Mike.
It's getting weirder and weirder, Tom. A Marion, PA firefighter who was airlifted by helicopter when he was hit by a car last week along a roadway at a previous crash is recovering. And he had moderate injuries after being hit by the car. did fail to stop at the direction of a fire police officer. The driver ignored the fire police, a 70-year-old driver who failed to stop on the demand of the fire police who was rerouting traffic and continued at 55 miles an hour into the scene and struck this firefighter. She continued on to hit another vehicle, pushed it backward into a PA State police cruiser and a semi-truck. She was taken for treatment of her minor injuries. She was wearing a seatbelt. How could this have happened? Because this 70-year-old senior citizen had just recently been declared legally blind, and she was the only person in the car at the time that she was driving. So, yes, I guess you have people out there that are truly blind trying to drive, and you can't make that up either.
No, I guess then at that point it doesn't make a difference how NFPA compliant your apparatus is or what color the chevrons are, because when they're going to ask the individual, what did you see before you hit the vehicle, she can legally and probably honestly say by putting her hand on the Bible, I didn't see anything, and that wouldn't necessarily be a lie at that point.
Right, and prior to this, Tom, the weirdest alongside the highway incident I had was a couple summers ago in Ohio when a young lady bounced off a fire truck and continued down the road, and she was arrested by police. And what was she doing while she was trying to drive? She was actually trying to breastfeed her infant. But somehow I think the blind driver here even outdoes her. So, again, you just can't make any of this stuff up. And if you're going to operate along the highways, you need to act as though everybody's trying to run you over. Why? Because they probably are. And in another sad testament for the fire service, unfortunately, an intoxicated volunteer firefighter from my home county of Orange here in New York State took his station's truck for a joyride this past weekend, crashed it into a telephone pole, according to initial police reports. The fire chief had gotten a call at 2 a.m. From one of his rookie volunteers who was 23 years old. How do you begin to even empathize with the chief, the poor chief here? He had told the chief that he was in a fight, and then the chief met the firefighter at the station, and he spotted a banged-up fire truck. It was an F-250 Ford, smaller truck. And then finally, the chief questioned him some more and found out that he had taken the 97 F-250 for a joyride after his altercation. And the firefighter is now being charged with felony driving while intoxicated, grand larceny, and criminal mischief. Not a great way to start your firefighting career, and our thoughts and prayers go out with the poor fire chief who's a volunteer who's doing this for free and gets a phone call like that at 2 a.m. in the morning. Just hard to believe that somebody would put you through something like that. And then finally, our last newspaper item, and it just, if you are a firefighter's firefighter like Tom and I are, this stuff like this just really fries you. A community in Florida was questioning the fire department's expenditure of funds on chevron striping the rear of their apparatus, which, by the way, is really a moot point after January 1 of 2009, because that is going to be mandated by the new NFPA 1901 changes. But this fire department got a new graphics package, which cost $38,000, certainly not chump change, but golly, it just seems to me, Tom, that if it saves one life, that it just has to be worth it. Any thoughts that you might have?
Well, you know, Mike, unfortunately, I think just a couple of things, going back to the earlier story that you had about the young firefighter there locally in Orange County that got into a fight. There's a couple of things, I think, just dynamics that are happening to our disadvantage, but within the fire service in general. One, for certain, we are no longer looked upon as the sacred cows, the good guys, the people who always do the right stuff, and that people just blindly, possibly in the past, would have, you know, given us a tactical approval for just about anything that the department wanted to do. Certainly when you look at what's going on, I doubt that it's relegated just to the Northeast here where Michael and I live, and certainly as I think amplified in the story there, the community in Florida, that people by and large are just, they're fed up with municipal government in a lot of cases, with what it costs them for taxes. Up here locally within the area where I live, and I know it's not a lot different down in Mike's area, school district budgets, which historically the way our state operates, have to get put up to a public vote. It's awful lot of those do not get don't pass muster the first time, and they ended up being re-voted on, and where the communities have to go and trim the budgets. The fire departments are largely in the same realm. There's a number of all-volunteer organizations I'm very familiar with here in the upstate New York area where either fire station additions or new fire stations, when they got put up for a public vote to in order enable the community to either encumber the money, bond for the money, or do whatever, that they pretty resoundingly got voted down. I know when several of them got tagged into tied into other things that were going on when they have their annual fire district elections, which occur the first week of December here historically in the Empire State, that many of those got voted down, even though the departments lobbied very heavily. So you look at, on one hand, you know, we're killing firefighters, we're killing and injuring, as Mike opened up the show today with, police officers on when they're operating on these on-highway incidents where you would think that something safety-related would get a two thumbs up and be the proverbial no-brainer, and people say, sure, or no problem with that, we'll go for that. You find out people just across the board, if they have an opportunity to say, to vote in with their conscience and vote no, and it's something that's monetarily related, you find that in a lot of cases, it's just no. And when you ask them why, it's not that they dislike the fire department or anything. It's just the fact that they are not in the mood to spend any more money and to see their taxes increased. And unfortunately, Mike, I think that's something that we're going to have to see moving forward.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There was just a bond referendum down here for a new firehouse. For a group that, quite frankly, really do need a new firehouse. They're operating out of quarters that were built in the early 20s, and it got resoundingly defeated by the better part of 100 votes. So they're going to go back to the drawing board there. So I think, rightfully so, Tom, as you stated, that times are a-changing, and we're going to have to become more ingenious in finding ways to meet fire protection needs and still try and stay on the good side of taxpayers. It's going to be very difficult moving forward, though.
Yeah, absolutely, Michael. Well, you know, our next item up, we were just recently come back several weeks ago from attending the Fire Department Instructors Conference out in Indianapolis, Indiana. It certainly starts off with one of the larger trade shows with respect to new apparatus, components, warning lights, hand tools, all different kinds of things. Mike, I know you had a little bit more opportunity than did I to maybe get around and get out and see all of the stuff, the latest and greatest. Was there anything there that particularly set you back or made you go back a second time or maybe even stop to ask the, you know, the vendor in the in the booth area, what his product does and what it worked. Anything that particularly struck you?
Well, on the upside, we saw some of the new technologies that are going to be put into the apparatus after January 1 of 2009, although some already exist and alluding to the vehicle data recording systems that are going to become mandatory by the NFPA after January 1, and also spent a good amount of time in the Caterpillar booth, where Caterpillar seems to me to be aggressively pursuing fire apparatus business, and perhaps that part of the market share that Detroit Diesel once enjoyed, as we had talked about last month, Detroit Diesel announcing that they're going to cease building fire truck engines as of 2010 when the new emission standards come around. But just overall, quite honestly, Tom, it was kind of disappointing just going from the manufacturer's booth. And I know you have some thoughts on that, but when a major player in the business hires a painter to come in to increase booth traffic, and although it was well-intentioned, it was part of a fundraising effort, but when we're not introducing any new products at the major biggest apparatus trade show annually, that certainly, for me, an apparatus buff, as with you, certainly causes you to pause for a minute or two. And I'm sure you have some thoughts on that as well.
Well, you know, there were some items, Mike, that I noted that were people did bring out, you know, new products. In one of the things that I saw that certainly, to me, we're talking about now major either body designs or new cabs and chassis. That Pierce Manufacturing introduced a new split tilt cab version of their Velocity cab, and there were some other individual things that you saw that different builders were offering. It was notable, I think, this year there were a couple of units that were on display. Very well equipped tractor drawn ladder from Bedford, Virginia. It was in the Seagrave booth, where that department, even though they had some limited funding after they purchased the unit, had done a phenomenal job of tool mounting and equipment layout within the body. And there were a couple of other manufacturers that had, as I would call them, totally outfitted apparatus, just didn't show, for example, a pumper with nothing in the hose bed and nothing in the compartments and just trays and shells. But they took the time to bring a piece of equipment that was reasonably well laid out and designed that showed how you use that compartment space, which we have spoken to previously, that's some of the most important or most expensive, rather, space that you're ever going to buy on the face of the earth. The one thing that did strike me, and again, there's no scientific data. Mike and I don't work for NASA here, that we have this group of scientists that are, you know, working and crunching numbers to back this up. But my observation about the show, while it was certainly well attended and did have some very interesting rigs there, I think there's a couple of dynamics that are going on within the apparatus industry. One that I think we had spoke about previously, that the numbers don't lie in that the numbers of apparatus that were delivered within North America, the United States, and Canada last year, the market was down some 17%. So that means that there were 17% less opportunities for the people competing in the marketplace, not just the apparatus builders, but now we have to think about the engine manufacturers, the people who supply the pumps, the gauges, all the different components or people that offer products to us. Think, for example, just about seats in apparatus, which Mike and I have talked about extensively. There's basically two major manufacturers of seats that sell to everyone in the apparatus industry, including some of the commercial chassis suppliers that supply a fire truck version of the Navistar chassis or the Freightliner chassis, Kenworth or Peterbilt, whatever it might be. And there's only two players in that market. I think in a similar parallel, look at the folks who make ground ladders. Yeah, there's a company, well-renowned company out in California that makes wooden ground ladders, kind of specifically for the California market. But beyond that, there's two ladder companies in the United States that supply all the fire service ladders that we might see. I'm a appealing to you here in your truck company mentality, all right, that we climb. Well, when the market's off by 17%, those people that make ground ladders, they're making doing stuff in other vocations, because if their whole business was off 17%, pretty soon you'd find that some of these vendors, frankly, couldn't survive. So you take that perspective together with, I don't care whether you watch the national news on one of the three main major networks, or you're like me, you're one of these cable news nuts that like to tune in at 7 o'clock and see what the cable news folks are saying. It's pretty hard to not get bombarded on a daily basis by the fact that our economy is not doing particularly well. The cost of gasoline, of diesel fuel, is skyrocketing. This all translates, if it hasn't hit home yet, it will pretty shortly by the end of this year. It's going to come to roost with increased costs in producing the components, not just that we use as a fire truck builders, but, you know, just consumer goods as well. That together with what Mike's going to talk about in a little bit, the increased costs that are going to hit us with the new NFPA standards, while it's somewhat nominal, all this stuff begins to add up to the point where, you know, where's the breaking point in the industry where with some communities are going to say, you know, we don't have enough money for this new fire truck. We're going to look at this older unit and maybe rehab it, run it, or worse yet, maybe just run it till it drops, because we don't have the money to buy a new rig anymore. And while we fully understand all these safety-related items and this new technology is great, we simply can't afford it. That's going to cause the market to stagnate or continue to drop off the 17% we saw last year. That relating to what everybody who builds their own cab and chassis, Michael, had to do to re-engineer their cabs in 05 and 06 to accept the 2007 engines, and many of the builders are going to have to be doing a repeat performance of that, and they're already working on it, to redesign cabs and cooling packages to accept the engines that are coming down the pike in 2010 with only a three-year break. You have to think that, you know, there's not a lot of people in the apparatus industry that either have the funding to just, for example, design a brand new body for the sake of bringing a new body to market, or designing a new aerial device, which could cost several hundred thousand dollars, you know, approaching over $1 million in some cases. You don't have the funding stream is not out there to support that type of R&D and innovation when they're having to keep up with the mandated standards, be they NFPA or EPA regulations with impact to the cabs and chassis. You combine that with the increased cost of materials and what inflation is doing to us. I don't think it's a stretch to understand that, you know, you're not going to see probably for the next 2 to 3 years people come out with a brand new whatever that's not necessarily related to something that was a mandated change. And I think, you know, I don't want to say that's a sad state of affairs, but that's, to me, I think that's a pretty realistic snapshot of where the industry is.
Right, and like you had alluded to, I mean, this is, for the next several years, we're kind of just keeping up with mandated changes. Of course, we have the NFPA 1901 changes that take effect January 1st of 2009, and then in 2010, we have the next and what would appear right now to be the final redesign of engine emissions and engines, and again, the major, you know, all manufacturers are going to have to redesign their cabs once again, which is the second major redesign in just a three-year time period, and both these events are going to certainly add a substantial amount to the cost of the apparatus. And that's over and above the annual 4 to 6% rise in cost of the apparatus, just based on operating costs, raw materials, labor, and of course fuel, which fuel is just wreaking havoc with everything. I just got back from a vacation in the Virgin Islands, and a gallon of milk in St. Thomas was $8.22. For a gallon of milk, and of course everything in that island nation has to be imported and transported in, but it just shows of just what the high cost of fuel is doing to just everyday durable goods. And of course this has an impact on the fire apparatus manufacturing facilities as well. So we're in for not a lot of just new stuff, but like you said, just have to be resigned to the fact that the manufacturers for the next couple years are just going to be struggling to keep their heads above water to make the changes that are going to be mandated by either the EPA or the NFPA. This is Firehouse.com, Apparatus Architect Series with Tom Shan and Mike Wilbur. We're going to take a short break and come right back.
Help me out here. TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects on Radio at firehouse.com with hosts Tom Shand and Michael Wilbur. A quick thank you to Task Force Tips for sponsoring this show, as they've done for the last year and several months. We really appreciate that. And if you do have any questions for the Apparatus Architects, please drop us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. Mike, Tom, what do we have to look forward to in the second part of the show?
All right. Thanks, Peter. Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about tool mounting inside the cabs, and I'll address a few things that we saw that were notable at the FDIC as the most recent example. Mike's going to talk a little bit about a couple of the specific upcoming changes. We don't have to use to say pending or presumptive anymore. They are going to be facing us with respect to the new 1901 edition. And then we're going to wrap up by answering one or two questions that have come in since our last podcast. So to the point of tool mounting, as most of our listeners know, there has been a standard established in the 1901 document for quite some period of time now, regarding having approved bracketry that is capable and certified to hold, withstand the force of 9 Gs, 9 times the force of gravity, for anything that you're going to mount inside the cab. And we've seen some really good examples of things that people have done, and some examples that maybe people were well-intended. We don't know really where they got off track, but we'll try to address those. So first, to the issue of what we want to push, pull, or shove into the cab. Over a number of years, it became pretty evident to both people inside and outside of the industry that where we had established a 200-pound load per firefighter per seated position in a cab was probably not adequate enough. So with the new 1901 standard, that 200-pound weight allowance is going to be increased to 250 pounds. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot. You know, you got a 4-person cab. Well, you need to have a sufficient axle capacity with an appropriate reserve that you were going to add another 200 pounds to the front axle loading if you had seating for 4. Well, you get some, there are some volunteer organizations out there, while they're somewhat waning, but are insistent upon having seating for 8 or seating for 10. Well, you get seating for 8 in the cab. Now that's another 400 pounds that you have to allow for personnel in the cab. And if you had seating for 10, while it's somewhat uncommon, now you got to allow another 500 pounds of weight allowance for that front axle capacity. Now, that in and of itself maybe is not enough to cause you to have to change and upgrade an axle, for example, from a 20,000-pound axle to a 21.5. But the other consideration is that the manufacturer in the fire department has to both be on the same wavelength with respect to how much additional weight they're going to put in the cab with everything else they plan to, as I call it, push, pull, or shove into the cab. The FCBAs are a given. I mean, if you have seating for 8 and the driver's seat doesn't have one, everything else is an SCBA seat, well, you have to allow for the weight of the SCBAs times 7 for that seating capacity. If you put a MacBook box or a radio rack in there, that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but then some of these MacBook boxes can become rather extravagant, and it can vary from as little as, well, a little modest box that carries, you know, 3 2-inch binders, and you get departments that have a large run area and rely very heavily on the use of MacBooks in 3-ring binders, and they're going to have 4-6. I saw a rig on display at the show that had a slot for 14 different MacBooks. Now, that sounded, in the beginning, a little ridiculous until you talk to the people from the department and said, well, you have to understand there's only two truck companies in this entire county, and we have to have a run book for every department in the county, plus we go outside of the county on a mutual aid basis. And that kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier on prior to the break about knowing how to get there. If you don't know how to get there, it's about time to shut off the emergency lights, pull the maxi brake, pull off the side of the road, and don't pretend like you're going in an emergency response mode if you don't know where the heck you're going. So if you have to carry 10 or 12 3-inch MacBooks around, again, that doesn't sound like a lot, but now that's another 60, 70 pounds of stuff. And that's before you get to what we're going to discuss now, hand tools. People want to put very common pair of irons inside the cab. Maybe a maul. Maybe a flathead and a pickhead axe for some reason. We've seen people put sheetrock hooks inside the cab. I'm not sure why they need to be there, because most of the time you're not worried about coming off the rig with a 4-foot sheetrock hook, but we've seen that. There's two problems relating to tool mounting. One is that the bracket has to be certified and approved to be used in a 9G application. And we have seen examples of people, for example, take a flathead axe and use a 9G bracket to secure the bottom part of the axe, and then up at the top where you should be securing the handle, that's secured by an old-fashioned tulip clip, all right, or a little spring-loaded clip. Well, that is not a 9G-approved rated bracket, and if something happens with your cab that you find yourself going over, involved in an accident, that thing's going to come flying out of there. We've spoken extensively, so we won't beat it up in today's podcast, talking about people that have all this bracketry, or they have the tools or hand tools or irons or the rabbit tool inside an enclosed compartment, which is where the stuff is supposed to be, behind a roll-up door or whatever. And after you make about the second or third run for the day, particularly in a fairly busy department, you're like, well, we ain't taking this thing out of the compartment anymore. It's just simply sitting on the floor in the cab, and now it's a missile. I mean, if you're going to do that, you're kind of fooling yourself here, all right? If we're talking all about firefighter safety, what Brother Mike's going to talk about is this little black box that's going to record a lot of the vehicle events and data, and we're worried about guys being seated and belted. Well, seated and belted, if you don't secure your hand tools, all that means is that the hand tool doesn't have to go very far because you're not going to move around. You've got a much better chance of getting whacked in the head because you're not going to be able to move if you're running your rabbit tool and an 8-pound maul and your irons and you just leave them sitting on the floor of your cab. Or, worse yet, put it in bracketry, but the bracketry is not installed properly, all right, or it's not the proper type of bracket. So you really need to pay attention to that. This kind of information has been out there for the better part of 4 or 5 years, and while we won't go out and name individual companies, there are certain companies in the market that specialize specifically for the fire service bracketry that has been approved, tested, and they can certify that the bracket will work and withhold and withstand a 9G force. So don't go, you know, the cheap route, and this is the part that bothers Mike and myself. You'll see an otherwise reasonably well-designed unit that you knew the people spent in excess of $400,000 to buy. And then when you get to the bracketry, to use Mike's expression to steal that, we go on the cheap. You know, they then spend $120, you know, to get 8 brackets and mount stuff inside and outside of the cab, inside the compartments, and then find out that it's secured, but it's not secured in a safe manner. So we need to raise and heighten our awareness of what this bracketry will do and in its appropriate mounting fashion. And if you're questioning if what you want to do is appropriate, got two avenues that we could suggest. Beyond contacting and sending in, as Peter mentioned when he brought us back from the break, send us in, you know, some digital photos of what you're thinking of doing in your equipment list and send it into podcast@firehouse.com. Mike and I will be happy to take a look at it and offer our opinion for what it's worth. You can also look at contacting the people that make the brackets. They have some pretty talented folks back in their manufacturing facilities. And if you tell them what you're trying to accomplish, whether it's inside the cab or inside a compartment, you can give them your tool and equipment list. They'll tell you, and they'll give you the part numbers by their brackets, say, if you want to retain this stuff and do it appropriately, here's what you need to get to be able to do it. And the other avenue is if your fire apparatus local salesperson that you're working with, if they're affiliated with a service facility through the dealership, most of those facilities have a pretty good handle as to what is appropriate to install in the cab in different fashions, or they've probably maybe already done. For example, you just say, I want to put a pair of irons inside the cab. I don't know how many different ways there are to do it, probably at least half a dozen to eight that I know about, and it largely depends on how your cab is designed and outfitted. So don't take it to do one of these self-help projects and after you buy your new $450,000 road rocket, think that you're going to do tool mounting for $150. If you do, you're not only fooling yourself, but potentially you're creating an unsafe condition inside the cab. And again, we won't cite specific examples of what we saw at one of the most recent trade shows, but we saw some examples where things were done very, very well, safe, in a logical manner. And as a sideline, yeah, it was great. It met the intent of every part of the NFPA standard. And we saw a couple of examples where people, for whatever reason, appeared to spend more money worrying about mounting stuff in the compartments or what they were going to do. And when it came to the cab, everything was done on the cheap. And in that case, you unfortunately kind of have your priorities reversed. So a few words to the wise on that. We'd like to see some improvement in that area. And again, if folks have any questions, they can contact Michael or myself through podcast@firehouse.com, and we'll do our best, very best to help you. So now moving forward here and into the last third part of our show for today, Mike, you have a few things that you'd like to cover and discuss with respect to the upcoming 1901 standards and how that might impact some of the safety-related things that we're going to be facing.
Yeah, Tom, thank you very much. We know that one of the mandates moving forward are going to have to be a chevron package for the rear of the apparatus. That's spelled out pretty clearly in the standard, as well as a couple other safety-related issues, five fluorescent cones, as well as a safety vest for each riding position on the vehicle as well. And, of course, this is all due to the number of firefighters that are being injured and killed along the nation's roadways. And we had talked about it before, just the dollar part of these changes that's going to be incurred by apparatus consumers for all of the 1901 changes could reach upwards of $6,000 to $8,000. Can you put a price on safety, though? The next that we found pretty interesting, we went to a booth at the FDIC that had vehicle data recorders, VDRs, and again, this is another mandated feature of the 1901 coming out and taking effect January 1st. And it's pretty interesting how much data can be gathered. There's a module that talks about seatbelt use where you can sit in the driver's seat and digitally see how many people are seated, how many of them are properly belted, how many of them have tried to circumvent the seatbelt, which I thought was pretty cool. If you sit in the seat, you get a colored light with that seat in the person. If you try to sit in a seat and hook the seatbelt behind you to try and disarm it, you'll actually get a red indication on the dash that the driver will know that you're not properly belted. And then once you are seated and properly belted, the driver will get a green indication on the dash that you have been properly belted and you are seated and ready to go. Pretty interesting about this technology, it also has a time and date stamp so that it will be able to be readily retrievable exactly how many people were on board the apparatus, how many of them belted up, and when did they belt up. So if you had the opportunity to potentially survive a rollover and then go back and want to buckle the seatbelt after the event is over and claim that you had the seatbelt on, you're going to be readily found out pretty quickly. The cost of these units, depending on what options you get, can run from about $1,300 to $1,900, but that certainly doesn't include hooking it all up, which is what the manufacturer would have to do, which is going to take some time as well. The main feature of the vehicle data recorder, all data collected is stored with a date and time stamp, so we know exactly when and where it occurred. Data collected includes vehicle speed, vehicle acceleration and deceleration. When did you step on the accelerator? When did you let off? When did an auxiliary brake kick in? Was it on? Did somebody turn it off? The engine RPMs and the throttle position at the time of the event. Was there an ABS event where the ABS computer was triggered to act? Seat occupied with seatbelt status, a master optical warning device switch. Did you have all your warning devices on at the time of the event? And then there's an option which is pretty pretty interesting. It's called a lateral G indicator, which will indicate how many G's and the position of the vehicle as it relates to rollover. How close were you? Did you get close? Did you roll over? How many G's were initiated during that rollover? The vehicle data recorder is stamped once per second in a 48-hour loop. It's sampled minute by minute for 100 engine hours, and all the data is stored in the vehicle data recorder can be uploaded and saved to a computer. And probably one of the neatest features, and again, it's an option, is that you can download the data with a handheld, basically, computer. It's wireless, so that if a fire chief wanted to see how you did on your last run, he could just point this at the apparatus and download all the information that was recorded and retrieve it almost instantaneously. And this one handheld data collector can do up to 12 vehicle data recorders at one time. And so I think one of the main questions is going to be moving forward here with this technology, Tom, is how is this information going to be used by the fire service? We know how it's going to be used by law enforcement. They're going to be able to download this and prove or disprove what you were doing was legal or illegal. But more importantly, what's the fire service going to do with this information, the fire chief or the training officer? Is this information going to be downloaded and used to be punitive, or is it going to be downloaded by the training division and could be an excellent arm as far as it relates to driver training and correcting potentially harmful or inappropriate behavior behind the wheel? I think only time will tell that, but there is going to be a tremendous amount of information that's going to be available as we move forward. Any thoughts that you might have, Tom?
Yeah, Mike, you know, I guess there's, as with most things, there's two sides to what you can look at. I mean, for years, airplanes and air safety has certainly been paramount within that industry. and where any pilot getting behind the, you know, the in the seat of a 747 knows that you know, everything that he does with respect to operationally using that aircraft to get people from one point to the other is being monitored. And I guess that's where we in the fire service have had issues, that we've in some jurisdictions we've had this thought process that, well, and Big Brother's kind of watching us here, and we're not real happy with the fact that, you know, people would think in a certain type of organization where I just don't like the fact that, you know, this guy could be questioning my driving techniques. Well, in the situation that we find ourselves in, a lot of communities, as we talked about, the fire service is no longer the sacred cow. If you're driving a fire truck and you pile into the back of a taxi that Mrs. Smith is getting out of after coming back from the grocery store buying her weekly provisions, and the fact that you're driving a fire truck is not going to make you immune from the balance of the laws. Look at what the police agencies, we had talked about them earlier today, that, you know, most police agencies have dashboard cams to record exactly what's going on and what the officer was having to do and face when he pulled over that car for the traffic stop. Now, is that, you know, is that Big Brother, you know, watching as well? I guess you could maybe, you know, consider it that way, but it's done there ultimately for the protection not only of the public, but the protection of the officer. And I think that's the spirit with which that we need to look at this in the fire service. With, if we're operating within the safe parameters and the rules and the SOGs of our organizations, we really have nothing to fear. You know, if you're out there driving around like a cowboy, and I'm sure there, as evidenced by some of the things that we unfortunately have to open up our podcast with, that there are, yeah, every accident is tragic, and there's times that is the driver or of that emergency vehicle legitimately at fault from a legal perspective? I think if we're honest with ourselves, we'd have to say, yeah, given all of the apparatus accidents that occur within the United States, I would be hard-pressed to say that the fire department was in the right, you know, 98 or 99% of the time. We'd like to think maybe that we're in the right 100% of the time, Mike, but I'd have to believe that every once in a while we'd have to say, yeah, I think we're wrong here. And that black box could certainly be used in a very positive manner, as I would perceive, to be used as a training tool or as something to assist and improve the operation, our own operations, to frankly make us safer for what we're doing. And that's the spirit with which I would hope that people would perceive and see how that device would be used.
Yeah, very good, Tom. And finally, to wrap up today, Tom, I have a question that we can field. This comes from a fire department in New Jersey. I am in the process of putting together a justification for the purpose of a new fire engine for my department. The engine we are replacing is a 1988 and is reaching its 20-year life expectancy. I have been searching the internet to find case studies for apparatus accidents involving open cab versus closed cabs. I have had no luck finding such studies. As the firefighter safety issue is our greatest concern, I was wondering if you knew of any studies that would be beneficial to me in proving this concern to my governing body, and if so, where would I be able to find them? Any assistance you could provide would be greatly appreciated. Thank you for your time. Thoughts, Tom?
Well, the gentleman who writes in, Mike, is talking specifically about an open cab apparatus. I'm making a little bit of assumption here, but I don't think it's too much of a leap of faith to think that they are actually talking about a canopy cab unit where we have open jump seats. Now, to go specifically to the question, I am not aware of any statistical data that would show, you know, an injury and or fatality rate of an open cab apparatus versus a closed or enclosed cab apparatus. But I guess I would approach it this way. A couple things. Gentleman's talking about a unit that's manufactured in 1988. Even if the unit was in pristine condition with low mileage, you still have to face the fact that, A, the unit's 20 years old. he didn't define and give us the make and model of the rig. So another thing to look at is saying the cabin chassis, the body manufacturer, are those people still in business today? If either one, either component, or both are not in business, then you have to look at and say, well, again, the rig could be best case scenario, pristine condition, 20 years old, low mileage. But if we need to get parts or something breaks on this rig, where are we getting the parts? Because these people haven't been in business for X number of years. The third thing, but most importantly, would look at, we've talked extensively in the past about 1991 being a watershed year for the NFPA standards, where it changed a lot of things electronically, a lot of safety-related items. 1991 mandated a four-door cab apparatus. So at that point, you'd have to say, okay, forget the fact that the unit was a 1988, because it could have been built in that year or before, and there were some pioneering fire departments even back in the early 80s outside of the major cities that were buying four-door cab apparatus in 1980 and 1982. Well, if you had a 1988 rig that had a four-door cab, you might look at it a little bit differently depending upon what the balance of his fleet looked like age-wise. I'm assuming this is the oldest one, that you would say undergone at least three major changes and revisions to the NFPA standard in the life cycle of that vehicle. It's not compliant with even the 91 standard with respect to any of the safety issues. So I am surmising that if they haven't had the four-door cab enclosed, it doesn't have a load management system on it, probably does not have warning lights that are compliant to even the 91 standard. I would hope that maybe they threw some retro-reflective striping on it, but maybe that's not the case, that the thing, it doesn't have a stripe on it. There are so many safety-related issues that you could go to, combined with the fact the age of the unit, who built the unit, are parts still available. We've undergone at least three revisions of the 1901 standard since that unit was built. I think it would be appropriate to say, just based on that criteria, that you know, it's time to replace the unit, and you can validate the replacement, you know, based on that.
What would I take into the governing body? Would I want to get a copy of maybe the 1901 Annex D? Would that help me my lot in life?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, Mike. You take the Annex D and you would look at the requirements of the things in there and say, okay, well, if we need to play the issue of cost minimalization and a new little, you know, government buzzword, that you say, okay, well, what's the least amount of cost that would cost us to take this 1988 unit and at least bring it into compliance with the 91 version of the NFPA standard? So if you're talking four-door cab and the other safety enhancements, the four-door cab may or may not require a front axle change based on what the in-service weight of the vehicle is now, and you throw that into the mix, you could be spending upwards of $120,000, conservatively, to as much as $150,000, $160,000 to try to bring that unit into compliance with the standard at the point where, at least to bring it into safety compliance, to get it close to the requirements of what NXD is recommending. At that point, you'd have to look at, well, what did you pay for the thing in 1988? To throw $150,000 at a rig that's 20 years old, at least at face value to me, seems like that would be pretty fruitless. I think you would then say, from an investment standpoint and from getting your return on the investment, you'd be better off spending that money to do two things. Either A, assuming that you have the financial resources, go out and buy yourself a brand new piece of apparatus that meets the needs of your community, and you're going to have to figure out how to pay for it. The other alternative, I keep this in my vest pocket. The other alternative would be, okay, if it can be proven or you're in a financial situation where you cannot afford the cost of a brand new piece of apparatus to replace that 20-year-old unit, then I would look at alternatively going into the used truck market to buy somewhere between a 5 to 10-year-old used unit that meets the majority of your requirements, that is already potentially NFPA compliant and could act as a stopgap, so to speak, until such point that you could afford to buy a new unit. But unfortunately, you can't go to the NFPA. There's no study that I know of that will show you, you know, increased cost. I know they've been through the National Fire Academy. There's been a number of people that have gone through the Executive Fire Officer Program that have written papers study or research papers to prove their own case in their own community on this, but I'm not aware of anything that's been done on a national basis. So hopefully some of those thoughts will help help the listeners and help you get through, you know, the bumps and bruises of that particular issue that you're facing.
Oh, thank you very much, Tom. And I think another thing in this age of lawsuits, you know, that certainly could propel a governing body as well to act. Certainly if a firefighter were to fall out of one of those open cab jump seat areas and get hurt or worse, we already have a case law where a manufacturer was actually put out of business in a litigation, in a civil litigation, based in part by that event. So with as litigious as society has become and inclusive of the fire service, to be part of a governing body and not wanting to provide four-door fully enclosed cab protection for firefighters could be penny wise but pound foolish in the long run, and could end up some serious legal ramifications for not protecting those firefighters. So any final thoughts, Tom?
Well, we hope the listeners have found this this segment of the apparatus architect enlightening and maybe helped you out of answering some of your unspoken questions with respect to either, you know, industry trends, what's going on, what we're facing from a safety perspective out there, and understand that our job is dangerous enough on any given day with all the other hazards that we're facing. So to be able to drive in what Brother Mike refers to as a safe and sane manner, we spoke, make sure you know how you're getting there, no matter whether you're, you know, relying upon your little Garmin GPS or you got the old-fashioned three-ring map up there that shows you the best route to get there, and you know how you're going to safely position and operate the apparatus while you're there and be seated and belted, whether you have that little black box or not, really immaterial. We want to have everybody be safe and get home in one piece. So, Mike, any final thoughts from you?
I think that'll do it for now, Tom. We'd like to sign off now. This is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. Thanking you for tuning in, and we'll see you next month on the radio.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio. We'll be right back.